so much eulogy abroad. One of the most famous of German scientists, the physiologist Émile Dubois-Reymond, was not ashamed, in an oration delivered in 1870, in his double capacity of rector of the University of Berlin and president of the Prussian Academy of Science, to proclaim that we, the University of Berlin, quartered opposite the King's Palace, are, by the deed of our foundation, the intellectual bodyguard of the House of Hohenzollern. A Speech on the German War, London, 1870, page 31. It is remarkable that Dubois-Reymond should have thought it advisable to issue an English edition of this oration. It is well known that, particularly the scientists and engineers who had so loudly claimed to be the leaders on the march to a new and better world, submitted more readily than almost any other class to the new tyranny. It will suffice to quote one foreign witness, R.A. Brady, in his study of The Spirit and Structure of German Fascism, concludes his detailed account of the development in the German academic world with the statement that the scientist, per se, is hence perhaps the most easily used and coordinated of all the especially trained people in modern society. The Nazis, to be true, fired a good many university professors and dismissed a good many scientists from research laboratories. But the professors were primarily among the social sciences, where there was more common awareness of and a more persistent criticism of the Nazi programs, and not among the natural sciences, where thinking is supposed to be most rigorous. Those dismissed in this latter field were primarily Jewish, or exceptions to the generalizations made above, because of the equally uncritical acceptance of beliefs running contrary to Nazi views. Consequently, the Nazis were able to coordinate scholars and scientists with relative ease, and hence to throw behind their elaborate propaganda the seeming weight of the bulk of German learned opinion and support. The role which the intellectuals played in the totalitarian transformation of society was prophetically foreseen in another country by Julian Bender, whose Trahison des Clercs assumes new significance when one now rereads it 15 years after it has been written. There is particularly one passage in that work which deserves to be well pondered and kept in mind when we come to consider certain examples of the excursions of British scientists into politics. It is the passage in which Mr. Bender speaks of the superstition of science held to be competent in all domains, including that of morality. A superstition which, I repeat, is an acquisition of the 19th century. It remains to discover whether those who brandish this doctrine believe in it, or whether they simply want to give the prestige of a scientific appearance to passions of their hearts, which they perfectly know are nothing but passions. It is to be noted that the dogma that history is obedient to scientific laws is preached especially by partisans of arbitrary authority. This is quite natural, since it eliminates the two realities they most hate, i.e., human liberty, and the historical action of the individual. We have already had occasion to mention one English product of this kind, a work in which, on a Marxist background, all the characteristic idiosyncrasies of the totalitarian intellectual, a hatred of almost everything which distinguishes Western civilization since the Renaissance, is combined with an approval of the methods of Inquisition. We do not wish to consider here such an extreme case, and shall take a work which is more representative and which has achieved considerable publicity. C. H. Waddington's little book under the characteristic title The Scientific Attitude is as good an example as any of a class of literature which is actively sponsored by the influential British weekly Nature, and which combines claims for greater political power for the scientists with an ardent advocacy of wholesale planning. Though not quite so outspoken in his contempt for freedom as Mr. Crowther, Dr. Waddington is hardly more reassuring. He differs from most of the writers of the same kind in that he clearly sees and even emphasizes that the tendencies he describes and supports inevitably lead to a totalitarian system. Yet apparently this appears to him preferable to what he describes as the present ferocious monkey house civilization. Dr. Waddington's claim that the scientist is qualified to run a totalitarian society is based mainly on his thesis that science can pass ethical judgment on human behavior, a claim to the elaboration of which by Dr. Waddington, Nature has given considerable publicity. It is, of course, a thesis which has long been familiar to the German scientist politicians, and which has justly been singled out by J. Benda. For an illustration of what this means, we do not need to go outside Dr. Waddington's book. Freedom, he explains, is a very troublesome concept for the scientist to discuss, partly because he is not convinced that, in the last analysis, there is such a thing. Nevertheless, we are told that science recognizes this and that kind of freedom, but the freedom to be odd and unlike one's neighbor is not a scientific value. Apparently, the harlot humanities, about which Dr. Waddington has to say many uncomplimentary things, have gravely misled us in teaching us tolerance. That when it comes to social and economic questions, this book on the scientific attitude is anything but scientific, is what one has learned to expect of this kind of literature. We find, again, all the familiar clichés and baseless generalizations about potential plenty and the inevitable tendency toward monopoly, though the best authorities quoted in support of these contentions prove on examination to be mostly political tracts of questionable scientific standing, while the serious studies of the same problems are conspicuously neglected. As in almost all works of this type, Dr. Waddington's convictions are largely determined by his belief in inevitable historical tendencies, which science is presumed to have discovered, and which he derives from the profound scientific philosophy of Marxism, whose basic notions are almost, if not quite, identical with those underlying the scientific approach to nature, and which his competence to judge, tells Dr. Waddington, are an advance on anything which has gone before. Thus, Dr. Waddington, though he finds it difficult to deny that England now is a worse country to live in than it was in 1913, looks forward to an economic system which will be centralized and totalitarian, in the sense that all aspects of the economic development of large regions are consciously planned as an integrated whole. And for his facile optimism that in this totalitarian system freedom of thought will be preserved, his scientific attitude has no better counsel than the conviction that there must be very valuable evidence about questions which one does not need to be an expert to understand, such as, for example, whether it is possible to combine totalitarianism with freedom of thought. A fuller survey of the various tendencies toward totalitarianism in England would have to give considerable attention to the various attempts to create some kind of middle-class socialism, bearing, no doubt unknown to their authors, an alarming resemblance to similar developments in pre-Hitler Germany. Another element which, after this war, is likely to strengthen the tendencies in this direction will be some of the men who, during the war, have tasted the powers of coercive control, and will find it difficult to reconcile themselves with the humbler roles they will then have to play. Though after the last war, men of this kind were not so numerous as they will probably be in the future, they exercised even then a not inconsiderable influence on the economic policy of this country. It was in the company of some of these men that, as long as 10 or 12 years ago, I first experienced in this country the then still unusual sensation of being suddenly transported into what I had learned to regard as a thoroughly German intellectual atmosphere. If we were concerned here with political movements proper, we should have to consider such new organizations as the Forward March or Commonwealth movement of Sir Richard Ackland, the author of Unser Kampf, or the activities of the 1941 committee of Mr. J.B. Priestley, at one time associated with the former. But though it would be unwise to disregard the symptomatic significance of such phenomena as these, they can hardly yet be counted as important political forces. Apart from the intellectual influences which we have illustrated by two instances, the impetus of the movement toward totalitarianism comes mainly from the two great vested interests, organized capital and organized labor. Probably the greatest menace of all is the fact that the policies of these two most powerful groups point in the same direction. They do this through their common and often concerted support of the monopolistic organization of industry. And it is this tendency which is the great immediate danger. While there is no reason to believe that this movement is inevitable, there can be little doubt that if we continue on the path we have been treading, it will lead us to totalitarianism. This movement is, of course, deliberately planned mainly by the capitalist organizers of monopolies, and they are thus one of the main sources of this danger. Their responsibility is not altered by the fact that their aim is not a totalitarian system, but rather a sort of corporative society in which the organized industries would appear as semi-independent and self-governing estates. But they are as short-sighted as were their German colleagues in believing that they will be allowed not only to create, but also for any length of time to run such a system. The decisions which the managers of such an organized industry would constantly have to make are not decisions which any society will long leave to private individuals. A state which allows such enormous aggregations of power to grow up cannot afford to let this power rest entirely in private control. Nor is the belief any less illusory that, in such conditions, the entrepreneurs will be long allowed to enjoy the favored position which, in a competitive society, is justified by the fact that, of the many who take the risks, only a few achieve the success the chances of which make the risk worth taking. It is not surprising that entrepreneurs should like to enjoy both the high income which, in a competitive society, the successful ones among them gain, and the security of the civil servant. So long as a large sector of private industry exists side by side with the government-run industry, great industrial talent is likely to command high salaries, even in fairly secure positions. But while the entrepreneurs may well see their expectations borne out during a transition stage, it will not be long before they will find, as their German colleagues did, that they are no longer masters, but will in every respect have to be satisfied with whatever power and emoluments the government will concede them. Unless the argument of this book has been completely misunderstood, the author will not be suspected of any tenderness toward the capitalists if he stresses here that it would, nevertheless, be a mistake to put the blame for the modern movement toward monopoly exclusively or mainly on that class. Their propensity in this direction is neither new, nor would it by itself be likely to become a formidable power. The fatal development was that they have succeeded in enlisting the support of an ever-increasing number of other groups and, with their help, in obtaining the support of the state. In some measure, the monopolists have gained this support either by letting other groups participate in their gains or, and perhaps even more frequently, by persuading them that the formation of monopolies was in the public interest. But the change in public opinion, which, through its influence on legislation and judicature, has been the most important factor to make this development possible, is more than anything the result of the propaganda against competition by the left. Compare on this the instructive article by W. Arthur Lewis, Monopoly and the Law, Modern Law Review, Volume 6, Number 3, April 1943. Very frequently, even measures aimed against the monopolists, in fact, serve only to strengthen the power of monopoly. Every raid on the gains of monopoly, be it in the interest of particular groups or of the state as a whole, tends to create new vested interests which will help to bolster up monopoly. A system in which large, privileged groups profit from the gains of monopoly may be politically much more dangerous, and monopoly in such a system certainly is much more powerful than in one where the profits go to a limited few. But though it should be clear that, for example, the higher wages which the monopolist is in a position to pay are just as much the result of exploitation as his own profit, and are just as certain to make poorer not only all the consumers, but still more all other wage earners, not merely those who benefit from it. But the public generally nowadays accept the ability to pay higher wages as a legitimate argument in favor of monopoly. Even more surprising, perhaps, is the remarkable tenderness which many socialists are likely to show toward the rentier bondholders, to whom monopolist organization of industry frequently guarantees secure incomes. That their blind enmity to profits should lead people to represent effortless fixed income as socially or ethically more desirable than profits and to accept even monopoly to secure such a guaranteed income to, for example, railway bondholders, is one of the most extraordinary symptoms of the perversion of values which has taken place during the last generation. There is serious reason for doubt whether even in those cases where monopoly is inevitable, the best way of controlling it is to put it in the hands of the state. If only a single industry were in question, this might well be so. But when we have to deal with many different monopolistic industries, there is much to be said for leaving them in different private hands rather than combining them under the single control of the state. Even if railways, road and air transport, or the supply of gas and electricity were all inevitably monopolies, the consumer is unquestionably in a much stronger position so long as they remain separate monopolies than when they are coordinated by a central control. Private monopoly is scarcely ever complete, and even more rarely of long duration, or able to disregard potential competition. But a state monopoly is always a state-protected monopoly, protected against both potential competition and effective criticism. It means, in most instances, that a temporary monopoly is given the power to secure its position for all time, a power almost certain to be used. Where the power which ought to check and control monopoly becomes interested in sheltering and defending its appointees, where for the government to remedy an abuse is to admit responsibility for it, and where criticism of the actions of monopoly means criticism of the government, there is little hope of monopoly becoming the servant of the community. A state which is entangled in all directions in the running of monopolistic enterprise, while it would possess crushing power over the individual, would yet be a weak state insofar as its freedom in formulating policy is concerned. The machinery of monopoly becomes identical with the machinery of the state, and the state itself becomes more and more identified with the interests of those who run things than with the interests of the people in general. The probability is that, wherever monopoly is really inevitable, the plan which used to be preferred by Americans, of a strong state control over private monopolies, if consistently pursued, offers a better chance of satisfactory results than state management. This would at least seem to be so where the state enforces a stringent price control, which leaves no room for extraordinary profits in which others than the monopolists can participate. Even if this should have the effect, as it sometimes had with American public utilities, that the services of the monopolistic industries would become less satisfactory than they might be. This would be a small price to pay for an effective check on the powers of monopoly. Personally, I should much prefer to have to put up with some such inefficiency than have organized monopoly control my ways of life. Such a method of dealing with monopoly, which would rapidly make the position of the monopolist the least eligible among entrepreneurial positions, would also do as much as anything to reduce monopoly to the spheres where it is inevitable, and to stimulate the invention of substitutes which can be provided competitively. Only make the position of the monopolist once more that of the whipping boy of economic policy, and you will be surprised how quickly most of the abler entrepreneurs will rediscover their taste for the bracing air of competition. The problem of monopoly would not be difficult as it is if it were only the capitalist monopolist whom we have to fight. But, as has already been said, monopoly has become the danger that it is, not through the efforts of a few interested capitalists, but through the support they have obtained from those whom they have let share in their gains, and from the many more whom they have persuaded that, in supporting monopoly, they assist in the creation of a more just and orderly society. The fatal turning point in the modern development was when the great movement which can serve its original ends only by fighting all privilege, the labor movement, came under the influence of anti-competition doctrines and became itself entangled in the strife for privilege. The recent growth of monopoly is largely the result of a deliberate collaboration of organized capital and organized labor, where the privileged groups of labor share in the monopoly profits at the expense of the community and particularly at the expense of the poorest, those employed in the less well-organized industries, and the unemployed. It is one of the saddest spectacles of our time to see a great democratic movement support a policy which must lead to the destruction of democracy, and which, meanwhile, can benefit only a minority of the masses who support it. Yet it is this support from the left of the tendencies toward monopoly which make them so irresistible, and the prospects of the future so dark. So long as labor continues to assist in the destruction of the only order under which at least some degree of independence and freedom has been secured to every worker, there is indeed little hope for the future. The labor leaders who now proclaim so loudly that they have done once and for all with the mad competitive system are proclaiming the doom of the freedom of the individual. Professor H.J. Lasky, in his address to the 41st Annual Labour Party Conference, London, May 26, 1942, Report, page 111. It deserves to be noted that, according to Professor Lasky, it is this mad competitive system which spells poverty for all peoples and war as outcome of that poverty. A curious reading of the history of the last 150 years. There is no other possibility than either the order governed by the impersonal discipline of the market, or that directed by the will of a few individuals. And those who are out to destroy the first are wittingly or unwittingly helping to create the second, even though some workmen will perhaps be better fed, and all will no doubt be more uniformly dressed in that new order. It is permissible to doubt whether the majority of English workmen will, in the end, thank the intellectuals among their leaders who have presented them with a socialist doctrine which endangers their personal freedom. To anyone who is familiar with the history of the major continental countries in the last 25 years, the study of the recent program of the Labour Party in England, now committed to the creation of a planned society, is a most depressing experience. To any attempt to restore traditional Britain, there is opposed a scheme which, not only in general outline, but also in detail and even wording, is indistinguishable from the socialist dreams which dominated German discussion 25 years ago. Not only demands like those of the resolution adopted on Professor Lasky's motion, which requires the retention in peacetime of the measures of government control needed for mobilizing the national resources in war, but all the characteristic catchwords, such as the balanced economy, which Professor Lasky now demands for Great Britain, or the community consumption toward which production is to be centrally directed, are bodily taken over from the German ideology. 25 years ago, there was perhaps still some excuse for holding the naive belief that a planned society can be a far more free society than the competitive laissez-faire order it has come to replace. The old world and the new society, an interim report of the National Executive of the British Labour Party on the problems of Reconstruction, pages 12 and 16. But to find it once more held after 25 years of experience and the re-examination of the old beliefs to which this experience has led, and at a time when we are fighting the results of those very doctrines, is tragic beyond words. That the great party which, in Parliament and public opinion, has largely taken the place of the progressive parties of the past, should have ranged itself with what, in the light of all past development, must be regarded as a reactionary movement, is the decisive change which has taken place in our time, and the source of the mortal danger to everything a liberal must value. That the advances of the past should be threatened by the traditionalist forces of the right is a phenomenon of all ages which need not alarm us. But if the place of the opposition in public discussion as well as in Parliament should become lastingly the monopoly of a second reactionary party, there would, indeed, be no hope left. Chapter 14. Material Conditions and Ideal Ends. Is it just or reasonable that most voices against the main end of government should enslave the less number that would be free? More just it is, doubtless, if it come to force, that a less number compel a greater to retain, which can be no wrong to them, their liberty, than that a greater number, for the pleasure of their baseness, compel a less most injuriously to be their fellow slaves. They who seek nothing but their own just liberty have always the right to win it, whenever they have the power, be the voices never so numerous that oppose it. John Milton. Our generation likes to flatter itself that it attaches less weight to economic considerations than did its parents or grandparents. The end of economic man bids fair to become one of the governing myths of our age. Before we accept this claim, or treat the change as praiseworthy, we must inquire a little further how far it is true. When we consider the claims for social reconstruction which are most strongly pressed, it appears that they are almost all economic in character. We have seen already that the reinterpretation in economic terms of the political ideals of the past, of liberty, equality, and security, is one of the main demands of people who at the same time proclaim the end of economic man. Nor can there be much doubt that in their beliefs and aspirations, men are today more than ever before governed by economic doctrines, by the carefully fostered belief in the irrationality of our economic system, by the false assertions about potential plenty, pseudo-theories about the inevitable trend toward monopoly, and the impression created by certain much-advertised occurrences, such as the destruction of stocks of raw materials or the suppression of inventions, for which competition is blamed, though they are precisely the sort of thing which could not happen under competition, and which are made possible only by monopoly, and usually by government-aided monopoly. The frequent use that is made of the occasional destruction of wheat, coffee, etc., as an argument against competition, is a good illustration of the intellectual dishonesty of much of this argument, since a little reflection will show that, in a competitive market, no owner of such stocks can gain by their destruction. The case of the alleged suppression of useful patents is more complicated, and cannot be adequately discussed in a note, but the conditions in which it would be profitable to put into cold storage a patent which, in the social interest, ought to be used, are so exceptional that it is more than doubtful whether this has happened in any important instance. In a different sense, however, it is no doubt true that our generation is less willing to listen to economic considerations than was true of its predecessors. It is most decidedly unwilling to sacrifice any of its demands to what are called economic arguments. It is impatient and intolerant of all restraints on their immediate ambitions, and unwilling to bow to economic necessities. It is not any contempt for material welfare, or even any diminished desire for it, but, on the contrary, a refusal to recognize any obstacles, any conflict with other aims which might impede the fulfillment of their own desires, which distinguishes our generation. Economophobia would be a more correct description of this attitude than the doubly misleading end of economic man, which suggests a change from a state of affairs which has never existed in a direction in which we are not moving. Man has come to hate and to revolt against the impersonal forces to which in the past he submitted, even though they have often frustrated his individual efforts. This revolt is an instance of a much more general phenomenon, a new unwillingness to submit to any rule or necessity, the rationale of which man does not understand. It makes itself felt in many fields of life, particularly in that of morals, and it is often a commendable attitude. But there are fields where this craving for intelligibility cannot be fully satisfied, and where, at the same time, a refusal to submit to anything we cannot understand must lead to the destruction of our civilization. Though it is natural that, as the world around us becomes more complex, our resistance grows against the forces which, without our understanding them, constantly interfere with individual hopes and plans, it is just in these circumstances that it becomes less and less possible for anyone fully to understand these forces. A complex civilization like ours is necessarily based on the individual's adjusting himself to changes whose cause and nature he cannot understand. Why he should have more or less, why he should have to move to another occupation, why some things he wants should become more difficult to get than others, will always be connected with such a multitude of circumstances that no single mind will be able to grasp them, or, even worse, those affected will put all the blame on an obvious, immediate, and avoidable cause, while the more complex interrelationships which determine the change remain inevitably hidden to them. Even the director of a completely planned society, if he wanted to give an adequate explanation to anyone why he has to be directed to a different job, or why his remuneration has to be changed, could not fully do so without explaining and vindicating his whole plan, which means, of course, that it could not be explained to more than a few. It was men's submission to the impersonal forces of the market that, in the past, has made possible the growth of a civilization which, without this, could not have developed. It is by thus submitting that we are every day helping to build something that is greater than any one of us can fully comprehend. It does not matter whether men in the past did submit from beliefs which some now regard as superstitious, from a religious spirit of humility, or an exaggerated respect for the crude teachings of the early economists. The crucial point is that it is infinitely more difficult rationally to comprehend the necessity of submitting to forces whose operation we cannot follow in detail, than to do so out of the humble awe which religion, or even the respect for the doctrines of economics, did inspire. It may indeed be the case that infinitely more intelligence on the part of everybody would be needed than anybody now possesses, if we were even merely to maintain our present complex civilization without anyone's having to do things of which he does not comprehend the necessity. The refusal to yield to forces which we neither understand nor can recognize as the conscious decisions of an intelligent being is the product of an incomplete and therefore erroneous rationalism. It is incomplete because it fails to comprehend that the coordination of the multifarious individual efforts in a complex society must take account of facts no individual can completely survey, and it fails to see that, unless this complex society is to be destroyed, the only alternative to submission to the impersonal and seemingly irrational forces of the market is submission to an equally uncontrollable and therefore arbitrary power of other men. In his anxiety to escape the irksome restraints which he now feels, man does not realize that the new authoritarian restraints, which will have to be deliberately imposed in their stead, will be even more painful. Those who argue that we have to an astounding degree learn to master the forces of nature, but are sadly behind in making successful use of the possibilities of social collaboration, are quite right so far as this statement goes. But they are mistaken when they carry the comparison further and argue that we must learn to master the forces of society in the same manner in which we have learned to master the forces of nature. This is not only the path to totalitarianism, but the path to the destruction of our civilization, and a certain way to block future progress. Those who demand it show by their very demands that they have not yet comprehended the extent to which the mere preservation of what we have so far achieved depends on the coordination of individual efforts by impersonal forces. We must now return briefly to the crucial point that individual freedom cannot be reconciled with the supremacy of one single purpose to which the whole society must be entirely and permanently subordinated. The only exception to the rule that a free society must not be subjected to a single purpose is war and other temporary disasters, when subordination of almost everything to the immediate and pressing need is the price at which we preserve our freedom in the long run. This explains also why so many of the fashionable phrases about doing for the purposes of peace what we have learned to do for the purposes of war are so very misleading. It is sensible temporarily to sacrifice freedom in order to make it more secure in the future, but the same cannot be said for a system proposed as a permanent arrangement. That no single purpose must be allowed in peace to have absolute preference over all others applies even to the one aim which everybody now agrees comes in the front rank, the conquest of unemployment. There can be no doubt that this must be the goal of our greatest endeavor. Even so, it does not mean that such an aim should be allowed to dominate us to the exclusion of everything else, that, as the glib phrase runs, it must be accomplished at any price. It is, in fact, in this field that the fascination of vague but popular phrases like full employment may well lead to extremely short-sighted measures, and where the categorical and irresponsible "it must be done at all cost" of the single-minded idealist is likely to do the greatest harm. It is of very great importance that we should approach with open eyes the task which, in this field, we shall have to face after the war, and that we should clearly realize what we may hope to achieve. One of the dominant features of the immediate post-war situation will be that the special needs of war have drawn hundreds of thousands of men and women into specialized jobs where, during the war, they have been able to earn relatively high wages. There will, in many instances, be no possibility of employing the same numbers in these particular trades. There will be an urgent need for the transfer of large numbers to other jobs, and many of them will find that the work they can then get is less favorably remunerated than was true of their war job. Even retraining, which certainly ought to be provided on a liberal scale, cannot entirely overcome this problem. There will still be many people who, if they are to be paid according to what their services will then be worth to society, would, under any system, have to be content with a lowering of their material position relative to that of others. If, then, the trade unions successfully resist any lowering of the wages of the particular groups in question, there will be only two alternatives open. Either coercion will have to be used, i.e., certain individuals will have to be selected for a compulsory transfer to other and relatively less well-paid positions, or those who can no longer be employed at the relatively high wages they have earned during the war must be allowed to remain unemployed until they are willing to accept work at a relatively lower wage. This is a problem which would arise in a socialist society, no less than in any other, and the great majority of workmen would probably be just as little inclined to guarantee in perpetuity their present wages to those who were drawn into specially well-paid employments because of the special need of war. A socialist society would certainly use coercion in this position. The point that is relevant for us is that if we are determined not to allow unemployment at any price, and are not willing to use coercion, we shall be driven to all sorts of desperate expedients, none of which can bring any lasting relief, and all of which will seriously interfere with the most productive use of our resources. It should be specially noted that monetary policy cannot provide a real cure for this difficulty except by a general and considerable inflation, sufficient to raise all other wages and prices relatively to those which cannot be lowered, and that even this would bring about the desired result only by effecting in a concealed and underhand fashion that reduction of real wages which could not be brought about directly. Yet to raise all other wages and incomes to an extent sufficient to adjust the position of the group in question would involve an inflationary expansion on such a scale that the disturbances, hardships, and injustices caused would be much greater than those to be cured. This problem, which will arise in a particularly acute form after the war, is one which will always be with us so long as the economic system has to adapt itself to continuous changes. There will always be a possible maximum of employment in the short run, which can be achieved by giving all people employment where they happen to be, and which can be achieved by monetary expansion. But not only can this maximum be maintained solely by progressive inflationary expansion, and with the effect of holding up those redistributions of labor between industries made necessary by the changed circumstances, and which, so long as workmen are free to choose their jobs, will always come about only with some delays, and thereby cause some unemployment. To aim always at the maximum of employment achievable by monetary means is a policy which is certain in the end to defeat its own purposes. It tends to lower the productivity of labor, and thereby constantly increases the proportion of the working population which can be kept employed at present wages only by artificial means. There is little doubt that after the war, wisdom in the management of our economic affairs will be even more important than before, and that the fate of our civilization will ultimately depend on how we solve the economic problems we shall then face. The British, at least, will at first be poor, very poor indeed, and the problem of regaining and improving former standards may, in fact, prove for Great Britain more difficult than for many other countries. If they act wisely, there is little question that by hard work and by devoting a considerable part of their efforts to overhauling and renewing their industrial apparatus and organization, they will, in the course of a few years, be able to return to and even surpass the level they had reached. But this presupposes that they will be satisfied to consume currently no more than is possible without impairing the task of reconstruction, that no exaggerated hopes create irresistible claims for more than this, and that they regard it as more important to use their resources in the best manner and for the purposes which contribute most to well-being than that we should use all their resources somehow. This is perhaps the place to emphasize that, however much one may wish a speedy return to a free economy, this cannot mean the removal at one stroke of most of the wartime restrictions. Nothing would discredit the system of free enterprise more than the acute, though probably short-lived, dislocation and instability such an attempt would produce. The problem is at what kind of system we should aim in the process of demobilization, not whether the wartime system should be transformed into more permanent arrangements by a carefully thought-out policy of gradual relaxation of controls, which may have to extend over several years. Perhaps no less important is that they should not, by short-sighted attempts to cure poverty by a redistribution instead of by an increase in our income, so depress large classes as to turn them into determined enemies of the existing political order. It should never be forgotten that the one decisive factor in the rise of totalitarianism on the continent, which is yet absent in England and America, is the existence of a large, recently dispossessed middle class. Our hopes of avoiding the fate which threatens must indeed to a large extent rest on the prospect that we can resume rapid economic progress, which, however low we may have to start, will continue to carry us upward. And the main condition for such progress is that we should all be ready to adapt ourselves quickly to a very much changed world, that no considerations for the accustomed standard of particular groups must be allowed to obstruct this adaptation, and that we learn once more to turn all our resources to wherever they contribute most to make us all richer. The adjustments that will be needed if we are to recover and surpass our former standards will be greater than any similar adjustments we had to make in the past. And only if every one of us is ready individually to obey the necessities of this readjustment shall we be able to get through a difficult period as free men who can choose their own way of life. Let a uniform minimum be secured to everybody by all means. But let us admit at the same time that, with this assurance of a basic minimum, all claims for a privileged security of particular classes must lapse, that all excuses disappear for allowing groups to exclude newcomers from sharing their relative prosperity in order to maintain a special standard of their own. It may sound noble to say, "Damn economics, let us build up a decent world." But it is, in fact, merely irresponsible. With our world as it is, with everyone convinced that the material conditions here or there must be improved, our only chance of building a decent world is that we can continue to improve the general level of wealth. The one thing modern democracy will not bear without cracking is the necessity of a substantial lowering of the standards of living in peacetime, or even prolonged stationariness of its economic conditions. People who admit that present political trends constitute a serious threat to our economic prospects, and through their economic effects endanger much higher values, are yet likely to deceive themselves that we are making material sacrifices to gain ideal ends. It is, however, more than doubtful whether a 50 years approach toward collectivism has raised our moral standards, or whether the change has not rather been in the opposite direction. Though we are in the habit of priding ourselves on our more sensitive social conscience, it is by no means clear that this is justified by the practice of our individual conduct. On the negative side, in its indignation about the inequities of the existing social order, our generation probably surpasses most of its predecessors. But the effect of that movement on our positive standards in the proper field of morals, individual conduct, and on the seriousness with which we uphold moral principles against the expediencies and exigencies of social machinery is a very different matter. Issues in this field have become so confused that it is necessary to go back to fundamentals. What our generation is in danger of forgetting is not only that morals are of necessity a phenomenon of individual conduct, but also that they can exist only in the sphere in which the individual is free to decide for himself and is called upon voluntarily to sacrifice personal advantage to the observance of a moral rule. Outside the sphere of individual responsibility, there is neither goodness nor badness, neither opportunity for moral merit, nor the chance of proving one's conviction by sacrificing one's desires to what one thinks right. Only where we ourselves are responsible for our own interests and are free to sacrifice them has our decision moral value. We are neither entitled to be unselfish at someone else's expense, nor is there any merit in being unselfish if we have no choice. The members of a society who in all respects are made to do the good thing have no title to praise. As Milton said, if every action which is good or evil in a man of ripe years were under pittance and prescription and compulsion, what were virtue but a name? What praise should then be due to well-doing? What gramercy to be sober, just, or continent? Freedom to order our own conduct in the sphere where material circumstances force a choice upon us, and responsibility for the arrangement of our own life according to our own conscience, is the air in which alone moral sense grows, and in which moral values are daily recreated in the free decision of the individual. Responsibility, not to a superior, but to one's conscience, the awareness of a duty not exacted by compulsion, the necessity to decide which of the things one values are to be sacrificed to others, and to bear the consequences of one's own decision, are the very essence of any morals which deserve the name. That in this sphere of individual conduct, the effect of collectivism has been almost entirely destructive, is both inevitable and undeniable. A movement whose main promise is the relief from responsibility cannot but be anti-moral in its effect, however lofty the ideals to which it owes its birth. This becomes more and more clearly expressed as socialism approaches totalitarianism, and in England is most explicitly stated in the program of that latest and most totalitarian form of English socialism, Sir Richard Acland's Commonwealth Movement. The main feature of the new order he promises is that, in it, the community will say to the individual, "Don't you bother about the business of getting your own living." In consequence, of course, it must be the community as a whole which must decide whether or not a man shall be employed upon our resources, and how and when, and in what manner, he shall work, and that the community will have to run camps for shirkers in very tolerable conditions. Is it surprising that the author discovers that Hitler has stumbled across, or has needed to make use of, a small part, or perhaps one should say, one particular aspect of, what will ultimately be required of humanity? Sir Richard Acland, The Forward March, 1941, pages 127, 126, 135, and 32. Can there be much doubt that the feeling of personal obligation to remedy inequities, where our individual power permits, has been weakened rather than strengthened, that both the willingness to bear responsibility and the consciousness that it is our own individual duty to know how to choose have been perceptibly impaired? There is all the difference between demanding that a desirable state of affairs should be brought about by the authorities, or even being willing to submit, provided everyone else is made to do the same, and the readiness to do what one thinks right oneself at the sacrifice of one's own desires, and perhaps in the face of hostile public opinion. There is much to suggest that we have in fact become more tolerant toward particular abuses and much more indifferent to inequities in individual cases, since we have fixed our eyes on an entirely different system in which the state will set everything right. It may even be, as has been suggested, that the passion for collective action is a way in which we now, without compunction, collectively indulge in that selfishness which, as individuals, we had learned a little to restrain. It is true that the virtues which are less esteemed and practiced now, independence, self-reliance, and the willingness to bear risks, the readiness to back one's own conviction against a majority, and the willingness to voluntary cooperation with one's neighbors, are essentially those on which the working of an individualist society rests. Collectivism has nothing to put in their place, and insofar as it already has destroyed them, it has left a void filled by nothing but the demand for obedience and the compulsion of the individual to do what is collectively decided to be good. The periodical election of representatives, to which the moral choice of the individual tends to be more and more reduced, is not an occasion on which his moral values are tested, or where he has constantly to reassert and prove the order of his values, and to testify to the sincerity of his profession by the sacrifice of those of his values he rates lower to those he puts higher. As the rules of conduct evolved by individuals are the source from which collective political action derives what moral standards it possesses, it would indeed be surprising if the relaxation of the standards of individual conduct were accompanied by a raising of the standards of social action. That there have been great changes is clear. Every generation, of course, puts some values higher and some lower than its predecessors. Which, however, are the aims which take a lower place now? Which are the values which we are now warned may have to give way if they come into conflict with others? Which kind of values figure less prominently in the picture of the future held out to us by the popular writers and speakers than they did in the dreams and hopes of our fathers? It is certainly not material comfort, certainly not a rise in our standard of living, or the assurance of a certain status in society which ranks lower. Is there a popular writer or speaker who dares to suggest to the masses that they might have to make sacrifices of their material prospects for the enhancement of an ideal end? Is it not, in fact, entirely the other way round? Are not the things which we are more and more frequently taught to regard as 19th-century illusions all moral values? Liberty and independence, truth and intellectual honesty, peace and democracy, and the respect for the individual qua man instead of merely as the member of an organized group? What are the fixed poles now which are regarded as sacrosanct, which no reformer dare touch, since they are treated as the immutable boundaries which must be respected in any plan for the future? They are no longer the liberty of the individual, his freedom of movement, and scarcely that of speech. They are the protected standards of this or that group, their right to exclude others from providing their fellow men with what they need. Discrimination between members and non-members of closed groups, not to speak of nationals of different countries, is accepted more and more as a matter of course. Injustices inflicted on individuals by government action in the interest of a group are disregarded with an indifference hardly distinguishable from callousness. And the grossest violations of the most elementary rights of the individual, such as are involved in the compulsory transfer of populations, are more and more often countenanced, even by supposed liberals. All this surely indicates that our moral sense has been blunted rather than sharpened. When we are reminded, as more and more frequently happens, that one cannot make omelets without breaking eggs, the eggs which are broken are almost all of the kind which a generation or two ago were regarded as the essential bases of civilized life. And what atrocities committed by powers with whose professed principles they sympathize have not been readily condoned by many of our so-called liberals. There is one aspect of the change in moral values brought about by the advance of collectivism which at the present time provides special food for thought. It is that the virtues which are held less and less in esteem, and which consequently become rarer, are precisely those on which Anglo-Saxons justly prided themselves, and in which they were generally recognized to excel. The virtues these people possessed, in a higher degree than most other people, excepting only a few of the smaller nations, like the Swiss and the Dutch, were independence and self-reliance, individual initiative and local responsibility, the successful reliance on voluntary activity, non-interference with one's neighbor, and tolerance of the different and queer, respect for custom and tradition, and a healthy suspicion of power and authority. Almost all the traditions and institutions in which democratic moral genius has found its most characteristic expression, and which, in turn, have molded the national character and the whole moral climate of England and America, are those which the progress of collectivism and its inherently centralistic tendencies are progressively destroying. A foreign background is sometimes helpful in seeing more clearly to what circumstances the peculiar excellencies of the moral atmosphere of a nation are due. And if one who, whatever the law may say, must forever remain a foreigner, may be allowed to say so, it is one of the most disheartening spectacles of our time to see to what extent some of the most precious things which England, for example, has given to the world are now held in contempt in England herself. The English hardly know to what degree they differ from most other people in that they all, irrespective of party, hold to a greater or less extent the ideas which, in their most pronounced form, are known as liberalism. Compared with most other peoples, only 20 years ago, almost all Englishmen were liberals, however much they may have differed from party liberalism. And even today, the English conservative or socialist, no less than the liberal, if he travels abroad, though he may find the ideas and writings of Carlyle or Disraeli, of the Webbs or H.G. Wells, exceedingly popular in circles with which he has little in common, among Nazis and other totalitarians, if he finds an intellectual island where the tradition of Macaulay and Gladstone, of J.S. Mill or John Morley lives, will find kindred spirits who talk the same language as himself, however much he himself may differ from the ideals for which these men specifically stood. Nowhere is the loss of the belief in the specific values of British civilization more manifest, and nowhere has it had a more paralyzing effect on the pursuit of our immediate great purpose than in the fatuous ineffectiveness of most British propaganda. The first prerequisite for success in propaganda directed to other people is the proud acknowledgement of the characteristic values and distinguishing traits for which the country attempting it is known to the other peoples. The main cause of the ineffectiveness of British propaganda is that those directing it seem to have lost their own belief in the peculiar values of English civilization, or to be completely ignorant of the main points on which it differs from that of other people. The left intelligentsia, indeed, have so long worshipped foreign gods that they seem to have become almost incapable of seeing any good in the characteristic English institutions and traditions. That the moral values on which most of them pride themselves are largely the product of the institutions they are out to destroy, these socialists cannot, of course, admit. And this attitude is unfortunately not confined to avowed socialists. Though one must hope that this is not true of the less vocal but more numerous cultivated Englishmen, if one were to judge by the ideas which find expression in current political discussion and propaganda, the Englishmen who not only the language speak that Shakespeare spake, but also the faith and morals hold that Milton held, seem to have almost vanished. Though the subject of this chapter has already invited more than one reference to Milton, it is difficult to resist the temptation to add here one more quotation, a very familiar one, though one, it seems, which nowadays nobody but a foreigner would dare to cite. Let not England forget her precedents of teaching nations how to live. It is, perhaps, significant that our generation has seen a host of American and English detractors of Milton, and that the first of them, Ezra Pound, was, during this war, broadcasting from Italy. To believe, however, that the kind of propaganda produced by this attitude can have the desired effect on our enemies, and particularly on the Germans, is a fatal blunder. The Germans know England and America, not well, perhaps, yet sufficiently to know what are the characteristic traditional values of democratic life, and what, for the last 2 or 3 generations, has increasingly separated the minds of the countries. If we wish to convince them, not only of our sincerity, but also that we have to offer a real alternative to the way they have gone, it will not be by concessions to their system of thought. We shall not delude them with a stale reproduction of the ideas of their fathers, which we have borrowed from them, be it state socialism, Realpolitik, scientific planning, or corporativism. We shall not persuade them by following them half the way which leads to totalitarianism. If the democracies themselves abandon the supreme ideal of the freedom and happiness of the individual, if they implicitly admit that their civilization is not worth preserving, and that they know nothing better